Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Larry Massett. In May 1993, in the south of France, a man, his name was Didier Daron, was parachuting from an airplane. It was a training jump. All was going well till, at about 1,000 feet, he hit a freak air current that was going up. All the way up. His altimeter froze at 25,000 feet. The temperature was minus 30 centigrade. Finally, the air was too thin to support his parachute, and he began to fall back down. He did have the wit to open the emergency chute just before he passed out. He landed 30 miles off target and 2 hours late, with no broken bones, but he did have to be treated for frostbite. Now, as far as I'm concerned, this is a good enough reason never, ever to go skydiving. On the other hand, my skydiving friends are quite unbothered by these anecdotal stories. They tell me the sport is a lot safer, statistically, than cruising around in a car. Besides, most accidents happen at home, they say, usually in the shower. Welcome to the murky world of risk assessment. How do we decide whether something is safe or unsafe, worth the risk or not worth it? Here is a case in point from producer Vince Winkle.
This is where the crows live now. Thousands of them in the trees above 101st Street. They seem to rule this corner of the city. There are no dogs or cats to chase them away. This section of Niagara Falls, nestled between the town of Wheatfield and the Niagara River, used to be called LaSalle. In August of 1978, people here stopped calling their neighborhood LaSalle and began calling it Love Canal. Today, Love Canal is synonymous with toxic waste. But this story didn't begin in 1978. It began 100 years ago. That's when developer William Love set his dream into motion. He planned to build a model city around a canal that would link the upper and lower Niagara rivers. A hydroelectric plant would furnish the community's energy needs. A bad economy forced Love to shut down the project. He left behind a canal almost 3,000 feet long, 100 feet wide. It became a swimming hole until World War II. Then, in 1942, the Hooker Chemical Company purchased the canal site. For 10 years, Hooker dumped chemicals into the canal, almost 22,000 tons of chemicals. Some were contained in steel drums. Other times, the chemicals were just poured straight into the canal. At the time, this canal site in the eastern reaches of Niagara Falls seemed like an ideal dump site. State-of-the-art, if you will. Its bottom and sides were composed of clay. That meant no chemicals could leak out as long as nothing ruptured the clay. Eventually, as the old canal filled up, Hooker covered it with a clay cap, put soil on top of that, and planted grass. In 1953, Hooker sold the land to the Niagara Falls School Board for $1. An elementary school was built, followed by the construction of hundreds of modest 2- and 3-bedroom homes. The post-war baby boom was in full swing. Through the 1960s and early 70s, the home sold for between $18,000 and $25,000. It was a working-class neighborhood, lots of trees, picket fences, gardens, all looped around the canal site. Lois Gibbs and her family moved into the neighborhood in 1973. Gibbs would later lead the community in its fight for evacuation.
Love Canal was probably the ideal community that everybody's looking for. It was a very young community, single-family homes. It had a low-income housing development to the west of Love Canal. But for the most part, they were like little townhouses, and it wasn't ridden with crime and so forth. We had lots of children going up and down the sidewalks. We had 2 churches in our community, a local drugstore, a short distance from work. I mean, it was a perfect community.
Joanne Hale also moved into the area in the early 70s. Like Lois Gibbs, Hale saw the neighborhood as a great place to raise a family.
When I first moved into Love Canal, it was a small, quiet community. It had 2 elementary schools. It had a local store where you could purchase anything from bread, milk, or your prescription drugs. Around the corner, there was a new mall that was just built within walking distance. And it was mainly a community of either retirees or young families just starting out.
Tests in the late summer of 1976 uncovered chemical contamination. This prompted the local newspaper to report on the testing and begin monitoring events in the neighborhood. just how to respond was bounced from agency to agency. Should it be the state's Department of Health or the Department of Environmental Conservation? Or should the Environmental Protection Agency get involved? It would take 2 years to decide. During those 2 years, visual evidence that something was wrong became more obvious.
2 years ago, after heavy rain, some of the buried chemicals seeped to the surface. Children suffered burns.
The canal cuts through the neighborhood north to south. 97th Street is on the west, 99th on the east. All the homes along these two streets had their backyards facing the long, patchy field that was directly atop the canal. It's where kids rode mini bikes and played ball. By 1976, there wasn't much grass on the field, but there were puddles that never seemed to go away, puddles of black sludge, and steel drums were starting to pop through the soil. A constant foul smell hung in the air. And yet people like Joanne Hale suspected nothing. You see, Niagara Falls has hundreds of factories, so strange odors are not unusual.
The other thing is no, it was not in our deeds, and the reason why it was not in our deeds is because our homes were not built on top of it. Our homes all were built adjacent to it. And if you are built adjacent to something, at that time when you purchased your homes in the early 70s, and well, even in the late 70s in New York State, there was never a disclosure clause in your deed. So, no, none of us really knew.
In the spring of 1978, the New York Department of Health began more vigorous testing. In June, the first official warning came from the state. The toxic wastes, said the order from the health commissioner, posed an extremely serious threat and danger to the health, safety, and welfare of those living near it. Residents spent the summer wondering and worrying. What would the state do next? They found out on August the 2nd.
Today, the state health department moved in, advising pregnant women and families with young children to leave.
I've had two miscarriages.
The evacuation order came like a bombshell. Joanne Hale was then 24 years old. She had one child, and she was 7 months pregnant.
That was the date that I got up and read the morning newspaper, Courier Express, and it said, pregnant women and children two and under are to be relocated out of this area due to toxic waste.
And you guys represent us, you're going to have problems. We're going to do everything. I'll never back up. Never, never, never. Get out of here.
This was the first chance residents had to vent their frustrations into the ears of state officials. State Health Commissioner Robert Whalen tried to tell the crowd,
she's been there for 8 months. What are you going to do for my kid? What are you going to do? Nothing.
Where they
got to
go?
If the damage is done, man, the damage is done.
Whalen was also criticized for advising only pregnant women and kids under two to evacuate the area.
Would you please tell me, do I let my three-year-old stay? She has a birth defect now. What do you expect of us? That is my child.
Ma'am,
where is the difference? What about the 7 and
there
the 8 and the 9 and the 10-year-old kids? How can you discriminate?
The state is trying to find new housing for the residents, who are also worried about their property being worth nothing.
I carried a child for 9 months. Our little Julie was stillborn. The loss of our child may be a direct result to the chemicals. Please don't allow this to happen to anyone else before you get them out. Don't let it happen to yourselves.
Within a week of the August declaration, President Jimmy Carter declared an emergency in Love Canal. This authorized the permanent evacuation of 239 homes, the homes that made up the first two rings of houses around the canal. Lois Gibbs had begun doing health surveys in the neighborhood, but she had no background as a scientist. She had married right out of high school. So one of Gibbs' relatives introduced her to Dr. Beverly Pagan. In 1978, Pagan was a respected cancer research scientist at the prestigious Roswell Park Memorial Institute in Buffalo, run by the state's Department of Health. Gibbs had explained to Dr. Pagan that she believed old buried creek beds were carrying chemicals far from the actual canal site. That would mean it was more than just two streets that were affected. Dr. Pagan's research backed up the theory.
I found that the clustering was along the old stream beds, and it was quite remarkable. The clustering was an increase in birth defects, increase in miscarriages, children with learning problems, people with seizures. I also found a fair amount of mental illness, a great deal of asthma, and skin rashes.
By now, Lois Gibbs had founded the Love Canal Homeowners Association. Their goal was that all the residents in the area be evacuated. They mounted a huge campaign to pressure the state and federal governments. It was one of the first grassroots environmental organizations in the country. Luella Kenny was not one of the evacuated residents. She lived a few blocks north of the canal. Like everyone in this working-class neighborhood, she still hadn't comprehended the severity of what was going on. But her family was very sick.
We moved into the house in 1969, and at that time we had two sons who were, figure out, three and one, and we thought it was nice. I mean, you have, you know, look at all that play area for the children to play and so forth. And then we had one more son in 1971, and it's the son that was affected by the area. He died in 1978 of related causes from being exposed to the chemicals.
John Kenny was seven when he died. At the time, no one knew to check for chemical residues in his system. Meanwhile, the canal and the 239 evacuated homes were fenced off, and the state began remedial action to seal off the dump site.
Finally, late this afternoon, the green light. Workers wearing hard hats, air packs, and disposable uniforms stood by as the first shovel of dirt was removed from the Love Canal. Slowly, the odor that the residents here had been living with for years started to permeate the air, but not at a dangerous level.
The rest of the neighborhood watched. Sam Giorizzo watched. Sam had three kids, all in high school at the time. He lived a block from the fence.
After I found out what was going on, I got kind of scared like everybody else. When I went to a meeting, I wasn't like Lois Gibbs, contamination, contamination, you got to move out. I used to ask one question all the time. Is this place safe to live here, or isn't it safe to live here? If it's safe, tell me and I'll stay. If it's not safe, tell me and I'll get the hell out and take the loss. And you know why I wanted that question answered? Because I raised most of the kids in Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. And Lois Gibbs said that if they stayed here, they're going to have miscarriages and everything else. And those kids were growing up, and they were getting close to marriage age. And they were scared.
Sam Giorizzo never left his home on 98th Street. In July of 1980, after almost 2 years of political wrangling and confusion between the state of New York and the federal government, Congress approved emergency appropriations to relocate 550 more households in the so-called emergency declaration area. But no one was forced to leave. Sam Giorizzo had just lost his job at a local plant, so he kept his house.
When you get laid off from a plant and you lose your job, you can't even get $25 for buy a tank of gas from them. Bank won't give you nothing, let alone give you a mortgage for a house.
Joanne Hale and her family moved to a new neighborhood. Both her children had birth defects. For her, staying was never an option.
They should have moved everybody out of this whole area, and it should have been a demand to move out. You have to move out. You don't evacuate half of an earthquake zone. You evacuate the whole area. You know, the same with a tornado area, hurricane area, any natural disaster. And Love Canal is a disaster. It just happens to be a technological, man-made disaster.
A few blocks northwest of the canal is where Emmett Barrard lives. Unlike Joanne Hale, whose house was sealed off, or Sam Giorizzo, who chose to stay, Emmett Barrard had no choice.
We couldn't leave. We could not leave because they would not buy us out. That fence right there is the boundary line of the Love Canal. Somebody in Albany drew a boundary line down the middle of 93rd Street. But the people who lived on 93rd Street put up such a complaint, they wanted out, that they moved the boundary line to include that property. That's why the line was moved over to their back fence. So I wound up on my property line.
What was it like to live here during that time?
Well, That's like looking at a garbage dump on the other side of the street. You're looking at houses that were deteriorating.
Did you ever feel at risk as far as the health of yourself and your family?
Yes, sir. I had cancer. My neighbors got the one across the street. She died a couple of years ago with liver cancer. Another one died, don't know what kind of cancer, on the other corner. Another gentleman here that backed up here, he was only in here about a year. He died from cancer.
In 1982, Emmett and Sam watched as the 239 evacuated homes around the canal were demolished and buried. Meanwhile, most all of their neighbors who were eligible sold their homes and left. The neighborhood had become a ghost town. Those who were not eligible were trapped because their property values were zero. Nobody wanted to buy a house near a toxic waste site. Today, all of that is changing. The Love Canal Revitalization Agency is trying to change the image of the neighborhood. They've even got a new name. They're calling it Black Creek Village. Since 1990, the agency has been selling off dozens of homes. Of the 250 that have gone on the market, 117 have been sold, and close to 50 more are under contract. These were the same homes purchased by the state in the early 1980s. The state agency got the green light in 1988. When the Department of Health released its habitability decision. It said that areas north and west of the canal were suitable for residential use. Harvey Albond is the executive director of the Revitalization Agency.
We can now look in retrospect and have for some years, as we have engaged in millions of dollars worth of studies, and we can determine that there were areas that were not contaminated then. They never have been contaminated, but they were. People were offered the opportunity of selling their homes. There were economic factors obviously involved in that. Certainly the value of their home at that time, given the perceptions and given the lack of knowledge of the situation, were certainly impacted. And so when people were offered a fair price by the Federal Emergency Management Administration, they took advantage of it. It is this area that we are presently rehabilitating and selling.
The homes come with a guarantee from the state health department. It says only that the houses are habitable. It does not say that they are safe. Lois Gibbs points to that ambivalence when she talks about these homes being sold. Today, she runs the Citizens Clearinghouse for Hazardous Waste in Washington, D.C.
When in doubt, when you don't know what will happen, and you do know what has happened in the case of Love Canal, then prudence says you don't do that. You don't move people in there, whether it's light industry, residential use, or something totally different. Why take the chance?
The houses are inexpensive, going for $45,000 and up. Ken Winard bought his house for $50,000 earlier this year.
We like it here. You know, it's quiet here. And as far as, you know, the Love Canal thing there, we don't pay no attention to that. I feel it's safer here than anywhere else. I mean, they cleaned this up. What about the rest of it out there?
Sam Giorizzo watches the new residents move in. His street is almost full. He is sitting in his living room, remembering when this area was a ghost town, and remembering the impact Love Canal had on his close friends and neighbors.
I'll put it this way. I don't know where you live, right? But you ever have one of your close neighbors move out where you live? Or a friend move away from you? Yeah, how's it feel? You get that empty feeling, don't you? Just think what it is like when your neighbors that you've been living with 15, 20, 25, 30 years start moving out one at a time. And somebody down the street's yelling, this place is contaminated, you're going to die if you stay here another year. You know what I mean now? Well, that's the way it was. And these people were really scared. They were throwing furniture out left and right because they were told that the furniture was contaminated.
As the years went by, the community that Sam loved so much disintegrated. He says more families became divorced. The quiet became almost unbearable. And then there were the suicides.
Which one do you want to start with? He moved down here to 93rd Street. He used to live on 93rd. You know what he did on his 19th birthday? He had a big party. He never woke up the next morning. Well, next morning they found him in the cellar. He overdosed on drugs. That's one. You want the one that will live down the street from me?
Yeah.
4 doors down the street. He showed the kids how to fly the kite, I found out. Then he sent his wife with the kids down to Didi's around the corner down here to get some ice cream. When she went down there, he went down the cellar and hung himself. He was only 34 years old. Who do you blame that on, the chemicals? Or the stories that were rumored around there from the press and a great association down there? You want some more? You want to know about the guy that was blind, that shot himself? He lived in 97th there. He put a gun to his head and shot himself. You blame that on the chemicals? Then you wonder why I'm mad? Those people shouldn't have gone through that. I could tell you some more.
Okay, we're in the Love Canal treatment room. And the main function of this room, of course, is to treat the leachate that we have coming from the field, the containment facility.
Brian Sadowski manages the Love Canal treatment facility, 77 acres fenced off, the gravesite, if you will, of 239 homes and an elementary school.
Until technology arrives where they can destroy the contaminants within the canal, we foresee this plant being here for some time.
For this reporter to enter the site, forms need to be signed, forms that release the state of New York of any responsibility. One part of the form reads, quote, "Hazardous toxic chemicals are present on or about the Love Canal which could be contacted, inhaled, or ingested, which may result in injury, illness, injury to human reproduction, or death." It also releases this reporter's future heirs from any claims. There has never been agreement over the health impacts related to Love Canal. While statistics of miscarriages, birth defects, mental illness, cancer, and dozens of other diseases were very high in the neighborhood, the state and federal government never did any follow-up studies. No one knows the real extent of the health damage at Love Canal. But while the northern and western reaches of the neighborhood have found new residents, the east side of the Love Canal is a different story. A house is being demolished on this warm autumn afternoon. It's one of many. The east side was not found fit for human habitation, so houses are being bulldozed and buried. The houses still standing are boarded up. Three families still live in this area of about 180 homes. No one was ever forced to leave this section, even though dioxins were found in the soil. But eventually, these families will be moved out. The state plans on building an office park here when the last of the houses are buried. A landscaping crew keeps the east side lawns green and trim, although there is no one here to enjoy the well-kept yards. Joanne Hale certainly doesn't enjoy them. She's 41 now. Her entire family has struggled with health problems, and she is angry that people are risking their lives to move back here, or that an office park is planned. For Hale, who moved out more than 15 years ago, there is still fear.
I, every night, the same as Pat, when you put your head down on your pillow at night, that's the last thing you think about, Love Canal. If your kid is sick, it can be a common cold. It can be because she was in a room with 10 other kids with chicken pox. But the first thing you do is you panic and you think, oh my God, this kid is from Love Canal and she was exposed. What do? All you want to know is how affected will this child be for the rest of their life.
Her friend Pat Brown stands next to her. Pat Brown's children decided this year not to have youngsters of their own.
And that is their decision, not to have children for that particular reason. He's very asthmatic and allergic to everything. My daughter has her birth defects. Did it come from Love Canal or didn't it? They haven't given me an answer.
What's it like to drive in here now?
I do it many times. And many of the people that were my neighbors do this too. There's something about it, and it, especially at holidays, it'll draw you back. And you come and you drive down the street, you always know where your house was. Mine's buried, just like Joanne's. But I have a driveway, a part of a driveway, and it's just like a tombstone. Just come back and just look. Remember the good times. And then I drive away.
There will always be questions here. Were all the health problems caused by toxic waste? Are the new residents in danger? Did the state react too slowly? But a few good things came out of it. Then President Jimmy Carter signed the Superfund legislation to clean up hazardous waste sites as a direct result of Love Canal. What happened here also gave the environmental movement a boost, and it made the term grassroots popular. The Hooker Chemical Company was purchased by Occidental Chemical in 1968. This year, a U.S. District Court judge ruled that Occidental does not have to pay New York punitive damages for the Love Canal disaster. Instead, the company agreed to pay $98 million in cleanup costs to end the lawsuit. Still to be decided are 900 personal injury claims filed in the past 5 years against Occidental. Lois Gibbs agrees that Love Canal was a missed opportunity.
We always said after we moved out that they should use the Love Canal neighborhood as a living laboratory in which they could look at the natural field mice and other animals to see what happens to them. And I think as a result of that study, had it been done over 13 years ago, we as a society would have had some information that would have helped the other 30,000 toxic waste dumps across this country where people are presently living.
It is criminal to move people in here when test results have not been given to the people that were evacuated here. People were moved out for health reasons, and yet all they've studied is the land, the air, the water, and the insides of some of the homes, not all of these homes. And they moved us out on health reasons, but they have yet to test the health of us in the 15 years later. How come? And yet they're moving in this other, almost another generation later. They're moving in people.
And that will be the first child that's born here with a birth defect. That I'm waiting for that. Because it'll happen again. It'll happen again. And of course we'll still have the same question. Is it because I live in Love Canal or is it not? Because those questions have never been addressed.
Return to Love Canal was produced by Vince Winkle. If you'd like to find out more about this topic over the internet, send us email. Our address is soundprint@american.edu. If you include the words people next door in your subject field, we'll send you an automatic response. Return to Love Canal is part of the People Next Door, a special Soundprint series funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU at the American University. Additional support is provided by this and other NPR member stations and the NPR Information Fund, whose contributors include the German Marshall Fund of the United States, an American foundation building U.S.-European cooperation. Write us with your ideas, your comments. Write us at Soundprint, 4000 Brandywine Street, Northwest, Suite 620, Washington, D.C., 20016. Cassettes are $12.50, and if you'd like to order a cassette with a credit card, you can call us at 202-885-1285. That's 202-885-1285. Our email address is soundprint@american.edu. Soundprint is Technical Director Anna Maria de Freitas, Studio Engineer Robin Wise, Production Assistant Francesca Raymond. Our Executive Producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Larry Massett. This is NPR, National Public Radio.